This is episode 405 of the Autoblog podcast. I'm joined this week by Stephen Ewing and Greg Migliore, and we talk about Steve's drive to the SEMA show in Hellcat Mopars, Jim Farley's recent move to head Ford of Europe, and we preview the Los Angeles Auto Show. That's all ahead on episode 405 of the Autoblog podcast. Hello, welcome to the Autoblog podcast. I'm Dan Roth. I'm joined this week by Stephen Ewing.
Good evening.
And Greg Migliore. Did I say your name right?
You got it. Migliore. Good
Migliore.
To be here.
All right. Let's start with the garage this week. And Steve, I think you probably will go from most expensive to cheapest. So I think, Steve, you win.
All right. That sounds good. So I just spent sort of an extended weekend with the very, very nice 2015 Mercedes-Benz S550 Coupe, the replacement for the CL, the two-door S-Class, and it is a damn nice car. There's no other way to say it. This thing, it's gorgeous. First of all, I love the way this car looks. It has this presence. The CL always kind of had this presence for me, but the S-Class Coupe, just with the new lines and the new taillights and just everything about it, it just looks really killer. Even, mine didn't have the sport package or anything, so it wasn't like the super stylish one, but it was the nice anthracite blue. It had the big 20-inch five-spoke wheels on it. It had the, as I like to call it, the Designo interior. I know it's like Designo, but
it's such a terrible name.
I call it Designo, but the only thing about the interior was it's gorgeous and it's lovely and it's so comfortable and so stylish and so sleek. It was white. They call it porcelain, and when you have porcelain colored floor mats and it's fall and it's Detroit and it's raining, they're not really that porcelain colored anymore. But holy crap. I mean, every single person that got in this car with me, they all said the same thing. They would just get in and go, whoa. Like, just the design of the interior, the refinement, the technology, everything about it is just so well done. And there's
I guess, here's a couple of things, though, right? Like,
okay.
Everybody goes, whoa, because I'm sure it's a ridiculously expensive car.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is the one I have is $135,375. So yes, it's not a cheap car. But look at it this way. Here's a good way to sort of put it together. I remember when the S-Class sedan came out last year, I had one for a couple of days right after I had a loan on a Bentley Flying Spur, and I honestly felt like the S-Class had a more premium, better designed, better tech, all this stuff interior for, at that point, half the price of a Flying Spur. So yes, it's an expensive car, but relative to where that interior competes in terms of like with against other luxury brands, it's easily the best. I mean, this is one of, if not the best interiors I've ever been in, ever. Like, short of like the Rolls-Royce Wraith, the S-Class is just phenomenal. And it's got all these little touches to it that make it really nice. Like, when you turn on the heated seats, the armrest on the door and the center armrest are also heated, which I didn't realize until I was driving with the heated seat on and I had just a short sleeve shirt on, and I like set my elbow down on the center armrest and kind of went, ooh, like, hey. And then immediately to everyone else that was in the car, I was like, you guys touch this. You know, so it's
you regularly do that? You drive around in the car, ask people to touch things?
I mean, you know.
It's a Mercedes, right? You know, you got to show off.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm like, hey, you want to get inside and touch this armrest?
That's such a tantalizing offer. I can't imagine. So did I
say it in that voice,
right,
too, every
course.
Time? Come on in and touch my armrest.
Is that what we're calling it these days? Right. So did I miss it? What engine it has?
It's the 4.7 twin turbo V8. So 449 horsepower, 516 pound-feet of torque. It's the 7-speed automatic, which is just super smooth. It's got start-stop, which is this is one of the better applications of start-stop. It's really, really, you know, like quiet, and you don't notice it, and it just kind of like quickly fires up, and there's not much to it, and then you go. There are some car, like the BMWs with start-stop, I hate. I just can't do it. But in this car, it was totally fine. I never at any point, you know, I knew it was there, and I could feel it working, but at no point did I think to myself, like, oh, I should turn that off, you know? I normally turn it off, but I didn't.
The last two cars I had with start-stop, I had the GLA 45 AMG with start-stop, which wasn't terrible. I had the Volvo S60 with start-stop, which was pretty dopey slow.
Yeah, there are. So I think one of the worst applications I've had was the Z4 with the 2-liter turbo and a manual, and every time you would like click it into first, the whole car just shook. It was pretty bad. So yeah, this thing has, you know, a ton of power, but it's just smooth and refined and nice. And I will say, to the credit of the car, this isn't an AMG model, mind you. It still has this nice burble from the V8 when you really lay into it, especially. There's this great growl that you can hear, even in this quiet, cushy, coddly car, that it just kind of makes you smile a little bit. And the thing just goes. It's really a remarkable car. I'm trying to, like, think of things I didn't like about it, and I don't like the touchpad for the updated command system. I don't like it in the C-Class. I don't like it in the S-Class. I don't like the way it works. But they still give you that big rotary knob that we've all become used to with command, and that still works just fine. So, really, I can't complain, but, I mean, it is 135 grand.
Right. There shouldn't be too much to do. So, am I the only one who thinks it looks like a Accord coupe?
Shut up, Dan.
You know, I could see a little Audi S5 just if you look at, you know, from certain angles, but I think it's a great looking car, you know, the whole Coke bottle styling on the sides, and, you know, it's got a lot of presence, like Steve says.
Yeah, it looks great walking up to it. I mean, my first experience with the car was getting home from SEMA, where I saw nothing but just horrifying, you know, like the last thing I saw at SEMA before I left was a matte pink slammed last gen Lexus LS with these huge, like, pink lined wheels on it and tinted windows and Lambo doors. And I was just like, you know what? I'm done.
You dropped the mic.
So and then I got on the plane, I come home, and sitting at the airport for me was this gorgeous blue S-Class coupe, and I just went, yeah.
Like, so did you like immediately get in and engage the hot stone massage and the money scented vaporizer?
No, I turned the air freshener off because I hadn't really used it, so I it was on, and I left it on, and about halfway home from the airport, I was like, oh. Okay,
why does it smell like Dracar? Why should
I? I feel plenty fresh for the rest of my drive home.
I feel kind of left out at SEMA. My my brother-in-law was there, and actually my wife's nephew was there. Yeah. He works for I didn't know this. He's lucky. He's on a Velocity show.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. Yeah. There's a lot of cool stuff at SEMA, but most of it is just – it's pretty awful.
Yeah, well, it's a different show than it used to be.
Yeah.
So
that's my S-Class. I like that.
All right. So we're going to go down the ladder a little bit now because, Greg, you're driving the Lexus RCF.
Yes, yes. And down the ladder is relatively speaking, because the one I drove this weekend was about $75,000, I believe. It seemed to have just about every option you could possibly have, and it probably still was missing a few, but it's definitely a sporty car, that's for sure.
Is it Lexus sporty or like actually sporty?
You know, I would actually say this was really sporty. I mean, it was more than I expected. This is definitely the sportiest car they've made since, the LFA, I'd have to say. I mean, and it even looks kind of like a baby LFA, if you will, with those kind of side vents and the way the front end is really long and comes to a point. You know, if you look at the front of the rear fascias, they kind of scowl at you. It really is, you know, it looks very much like that whole sporty, almost, you know, endurance car racing inspired styling that the LFA was going for. Only this is just, you know, obviously a smaller, lighter, you know, sports car. And it's I thought it was fun to drive. I was surprised.
I am not sold on the way that car looks. I think it looks best as an F, but I don't really like the way the RC350 looks. I mean, the line that I've used over and over again is if you look at the front end from some angles, it looks like it's already been in a crash. Just because there's like this weird bulge going on with the hood, and then these like angles and creases, and there's just a lot. I'm really glad, I will say, and I'm sure Greg will agree with me on this, I'm really glad that the one we have isn't like the bright orange that they offered.
Right. This was done more of a tasteful shade of red, if you will. You know, if there is such a thing as a very tasteful, bright red car. But, you know, to your point, it does. That front end is definitely pretty polarizing. A couple times, like, because when I got in the car, it was dark out. Then, you know, with the short days, it's always dark out, it seems like. You know, I'm walking away from the car in the light. I thought, whoa, did I ding something? What happened there? That looks weird. And, you know, you kind of do a double take with, you know, especially the way the headlights and the grill kind of are like mashed together into this, you know, it's almost like a ferret kind of scowl at you.
I was going for insect, but ferret works too.
It just, there's just so much happening up front there where it's, I don't know. It looks like if a big, like a shark were coming at you with its mouth open. And then like, I'm picturing this in cartoon form where there's like a shark speeding through the water with its mouth open and it's ready to eat something. And then like someone like hits it on the nose with a rolling pin, like in a Bugs Bunny cartoon, and it kind of stuns it, but its mouth is still open, but it's all like crumpled in.
Well put. It's
that's a horrible analogy, but that's exactly what it looks like to me.
I think it's one of those cars, too, though, that it definitely gets attention. I mean, I don't think I've gotten this many stares since I was driving, probably an F-Type, which, you know, those always seem to get a lot of attention. But I had somebody roll up or pull up next to me on Woodward and just lay on their horn, and I'm thinking, what is going on? And then I look over, and they just kind of give me this, like, fist pump, and I thought, well, okay, guess you're a Lexus fan. All right.
What's up, bro?
Didn't know there were that many of them.
Yeah, it was a little unsettling, too, because it was kind of dark out, and I'm thinking, what's going to happen here?
So this is actually no joke when it comes to performance. It was like a 467-horsepower V8. It's got some of the soul of the ISF in it. You know, the ISF was raucous.
It's definitely a car that could get up and go. I did a couple of long expressway like runs in this thing and put it in sport mode and, you know, ran through the gears with the paddles, and it can move. You know, I think it's like 4.4 seconds, 0 to 60. That's pretty quick, you know, and
yeah, it's not bad.
That's not bad. Let's remember the gravity of what we're saying. That's not bad. Like,
that's not bad.
That's like a half second slower than a 959.
Right.
Like that's really quick.
One thing that I found a little annoying with this car, I mean, you know, the looks, that could be subjective, but I thought the infotainment system was just a little bit, I mean, for a car that's supposed to be like this, like sporty, you know, albeit luxury car, but it was a little hard to just frankly change the radio station. I know that sounds simplistic, but you know, it's got that kind of Lexus style like mouse that they have in the center console.
Well, so here's my question. Does this have the I haven't been in our RCF yet, okay, but I was just recently in the NX200T. Does it have the updated version where it's actually sort of like the touchpad that you click on, or is it still the mouse that they've been doing for years?
Yeah, no. So this is actually like the touchpad that you click on, which took me a little bit to get used to because my hands cold and
yeah. Because I was thinking when I had the NX was like I hated the mouse, but I might hate this more, and I think that's only because I got used to the mouse.
Well, the mouse was a little more intuitive, and I think, I mean, honestly, in a car like this, I don't think it should really have any of that stuff. I mean, I get that it's a Lexus and it's sophisticated and it's luxury and all that. And this is like, you know, their new system that they're trying to make hay with. But I mean, it's just flat out hard when you're speeding on the expressway and, you know, just trying to operate the system. It seems counterintuitive to a car that, you know, is pretty much the best thing they have going as far as performance right now.
That's true.
Is that good or, I mean, kind of depressing all in one?
Something to chew on, that's for sure.
I want an ISF again is what I really want. I mean, the RCF is cool, but I really liked the ISF. I miss that car. I specifically miss, even though the 8-speed in the ISF was kind of garbage, I miss when you would really ring it out in each gear how at like 3,500 RPM, it would it's like someone went up to the volume knob and just like cranked it to the right. And all of a sudden, it just got super loud, and it was great. I loved that. But
yeah, that was definitely a rude Lexus, which was, yeah, I think, why it was so great. And
yeah, I like that too. It wasn't, you know, soft and cushy and quiet. It actually had personality. And I think the RCF has a lot of personality. I mean, not even having driven it, I think it's one of the biggest statements Lexus has made in a while.
But she's got a great personality. Yeah. And clearly we've discussed the looks, and they're not so much. And it's kind of a weird amalgam of Lexus cars too, right? Because they take – it's formed out of like a GS front end and ISC middle section and ISF rear end or something like that. Like they put these different pieces of the unibody together. And so I'm sure it feels really solid from behind the wheel, right?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, it'll beat you up a little bit, you know, over especially over these potholes here in the Detroit area. But, you know, it feels good from the sense of it's got a very connected feel to the road. The steering actually was, you know, pretty tight, pretty responsive. But, yeah, it'll even beat you up a little bit, which there aren't too many Lexuses that you could say that about. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's true.
No, generally it's the enthusiast beating you up over the Lexus.
Right.
That's true.
All right, let's take one more jump down the rung. I'm in a 2015. Steve, hold yourself back now.
All right, I'm ready.
2015 Dodge Challenger SRT 392.
Oh man!
And you are out of your mind for not liking this car.
It's not okay. I'm gonna have to. You know what? I'll defend it when we get to our next segment.
I'm just gonna say it's hilarious. It's I also have to say, like, I drove this car home after an event that we had up here where I drove the Mustang EcoBoost and the 5-liter Mustang, and then I hopped into this thing and drove it home. Holy crap! What a pig!
Yeah.
It's super heavy.
She's a big girl.
I love the engine and the hilarious 6-speed. It's like such a good time. And like, because it's got Sirius in it on the audio system, I just left it parked on the 70s and like every song was perfect.
Of course you did.
I didn't actually, but I just thought that would, yeah, it just feels like that car. Like, it feels like it should have an 8-track. It's got this one's Tor Red, and then it's got the red Alcantara on the inside. So there's like tons of whorehouse red in the interior.
Classy.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it is. It is like, it's the height of class in there. This is a car though that like I would easily hop in, drive to Chicago and back, and be like, yeah, sure, no problem.
Yeah, I can see that. Sure.
It's comfy. It's got a, you know, all of the virtues that we've talked about, right? So the trunk is decent. The back seat is a good size. My son who was 6 was thrilled with this car because he loved all the red and all the detailing. He was like, "This is a neat car." I was like, "It is." And listened to it start up and it was like, "Rawr!" Yeah, I love the sound of the engine. I love the 6-speed manual. High performance summer tires. Not so good in temperatures below 45 degrees.
Right.
So, like, I'm leaving work today, and I have there's a parking garage. So I come around the corner, and I'm going at a good clip. I'm in first gear. I let off the gas, and the tail just swings sideways, and there's a lady down at the bottom of the ramp, and she sees this big red car come around and it's making all this noise and it goes sideways and she just like stops. She doesn't know where to go. And I'm like, should I stop or is that going to be threatening or should I just like idle past? And like, that's the first time I've had that happen in a media car without like actually trying to get it to do that. And I'm sure there's like sand and stuff on the ramp, but it's a big car. And notice the bulk no matter what. They've done a really good job tuning it so that it copes with it. Like, its performance numbers are actually impressively good because you look at it and you go, there's no way something 4,300 pounds is going to perform that well. And it's ridiculously good. The engine is super strong, super flexible, sounds fantastic. It's got the selectable – it's got – what MR shocks on it, I believe, so you can switch the ride settings and you can adjust the steering weight and the traction control and stuff. So there's some SRT settings to it. It's definitely like a hyperbole car. It's not something you can sort of just like be subtle with. It's not that kind of vehicle. But I still think you're nuts for not liking it. It's $48,000. That's all the fun 50 grand can buy.
So I'm not – it's not that I don't like the Challenger 390. I'm going to save it. I'll get into this later.
All right. Okay. It has my seal of approval, although it's like – it's the most practical of the pony cars. It's also the least legit sports car of the pony cars, where the Mustang now is like I actually recorded a couple things while I was driving the Mustangs around just so I could remember my thoughts. My statement about both of them was like, these are actually sports cars now. They're not just pony cars, where I think the Challenger, and you guys would probably agree, the Challenger is still like firmly rooted in that big engine, big car, not exactly a sports car, not really a sedan kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's great, though. I think it's like, it is what it is. It's like, you know, you order a steak medium rare or something, and it's just a lot of power. It looks like it did in the 1970s. I mean, it's, you know, it's like, that's the kind of car you put down the windows and, you know, turn up the Boston or the Springsteen.
I was just going to say more than a feeling.
Exactly. It is. It's totally.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's definitely a throwback, but it's a really well done car. It's, and you know, it is quiet. Like, you can just sort of cruise with it if you wanted to. You know, it will relax on the highway. So there's that part of it where it's a decent sort of stretch your legs, take a long road trip car. And if you want to ring it out on the back roads, first, you're brave. Second, it'll do it. So that's impressive. It's definitely trailing the pack by a long way compared to the Camaro and the Mustang. So,
sure.
All right, let's do topics because we've got a few things. And you, Steve, actually, this leads in really nicely because you spent a whole bunch of time with some Mopars. Hellcat Mopars, though. That's the thing. Like, the
Hellcat Mopars and a Viper.
Okay, which they should totally make a Hellcat Viper. We've talked about that.
Oh, yeah.
But like, so the SRT 392 has the 6.4 Hemi.
Right.
485 horsepower, 475 pound-feet of torque. That's really more than this car needs. Already.
Yeah, that's totally fine. Yeah. And that's my issue. It's not that I don't really like the Challenger in the sense of I wouldn't buy one, but I get it. And especially now being on this trip that I did, I get it more. But for me, it's like the Hellcat, I'm like, 700 horsepower is just a lot of freaking power. And in the Challenger, which, I mean, the Challenger has a hard time, you know, putting down 400-something horsepower. You know, 700, it's still having some hard times with. But so what I did was, leading up to the SEMA show, I flew to Dallas, where a bunch of us met up and we were in a pack of Challenger Hellcats, Charger Hellcats, and Vipers. And we drove the long way to SEMA. We went from Dallas to El Paso on the first day, which the route we took was about 800 miles because it was a lot of back road. Then we went from El Paso up to Winslow, Arizona. Again, mostly back roads. So that
Did you stand on a corner?
It Sorry. Did not stand on a corner.
I'm sure you heard that line so many times you want to vomit.
I chose to ignore it.
Okay.
So we drove to Winslow. Again, mostly on back roads, actually on some great roads. And then we did Winslow to Vegas along, you know, mostly highways, but we got to spend a lot of time going down Route 66 and just seeing like all this great parts of the American Southwest, and we did one car each day. So my trip, the Dallas to El Paso run, the longest portion of it, I did in the Charger Hellcat, which I freaking love. I don't know why I don't really like the Challenger Hellcat, but I love the Charger Hellcat. But I love the Charger Hellcat. I love the way it looks. I love being in it. I love driving it. I love the fact that for the first like 4 hours of the journey, when all I was doing was just cruising down like I-20, I think it was, through Texas, you know, you're just cruising at 80 miles an hour and you're in a big, comfortable, well-appointed, quiet, nice sedan. You know, it's a Charger, so it's got all the good tech. It's got a good sound system. The seats are those nice, big, bolstered SRT seats.
Oh, I love the SRT good. Seats. They
it's
are
just,
fantastic.
You know, it's a nice car that just happens to suck down the fuel because every time there's a clearing, you can't help but just hit the throttle.
Doesn't it feel nice and composed at like 120? I mean, are you supposed
to? Yeah, it does. Yeah. I mean, so when we took it off the freeway and we were on these long stretches of just like dark, or not dark, it was daylight, but these long stretches of roads where you'd be coming down a hill and you can see for just miles and miles and miles in front of you, and there's no one. And there's all of us, like media and then executives from Dodge and all these people, and we're just in this line of 700 horsepower cars, and we're all like, okay. And
it's on.
We just kind of all like hit the throttle at the same time and went. But, you know, so we got off the freeway for a bit, and we were doing this run along these great mountainous roads right outside of Fort Davis, Texas. There's this section of roads it's called the Fort Davis Mountain Loop. And I mean, I'm in a Charger Hellcat. I'm in a, you know, 5,500 pound, 700 horsepower rear wheel drive sedan. And I mean, this thing took to those roads in a way that I really wasn't expecting. When you set the car up correctly, you know, you put the suspension in track mode and you put the traction control in sport and you're using the paddles to work through the 8-speed and you're just on the throttle. You know, the closest thing I can compare it to, I guess, that I've done in this sort of scenario was an M5. And whereas the M5 is really precise and it's, you know, it's like a scalpel going through this stuff, the Charger is really nicely composed and it does everything you want except for like that last second when you're exiting the turn, the back end just kind of steps right out on you. But it does it in a way that it's just, it does it with this growl and you can feel it and it comes through the steering and you can just give it a flick to get it back into line and then you just go shooting down the road. And it was hilariously fun. I mean, just doing that over and over again was great. It's sort of like, Dan, what we've talked about before on the podcast of the argument of like F-Type versus Boxster.
Right.
It's that same kind of thing where, you know, the Boxster is going to be quicker around a track, but I'll have more fun in an F-Type. Right. That's kind of how I feel about the Charger Hellcat compared to an M5 is I'm sure the M5 is a little more precise and it'll, you know, hold a tighter line and all that stuff. But the Hellcat is way more entertaining.
Well, also the Hellcat doesn't have fake engine noise piped in.
So. There's that too. It makes a great sound. And then, you know, we left that whole big mountain loop and we're back on the freeway getting into El Paso and it's quiet and comfortable and composed and wonderful. And the nice thing is, with the Hellcats in the SRT performance pages now, you can actually go in and you can adjust it to be either 500 horsepower or you can put it into valet mode and it's 300 horsepower. So you don't have to have it in that sort of always on feeling. You know, you can control it and do what you need to do with it. And it's just a quick button touch. So that was really good. That was day one. Day two, I'm just going to talk forever about this apparently.
That was day one. Just that was the recap of, you know, 24 hours of it.
That was the first 24 hours of my Hellcatting, and when I realized that even though like I'm not the target audience for that car, I really, really like the Charger Hellcat. It's a great car and it's really nicely done. Kudos to those guys for doing it. And for doing it for like what does that thing cost? Like $65,000?
Yeah, it's right in that range.
That's so awesome. It's so awesome. But So second day, which was about 500 miles, I did in the Viper. And this was El Paso up to Winslow. And the Viper, for long stretches on the freeway, is kind of awful.
Oh, come on.
It's not awful. Awful's the wrong word. It's just, it's not very comfortable. It's hard to see out of. It is loud.
Of course. That's, it's all it of those so best loud. Things. It's like... It's
but man, is it fun?
Yeah, it's like fun. It's like flying your P-51 Mustang.
Yeah, it was a ton
3 feet
of fun.
Off the
and
ground.
And then I remember there was this one instance where I got off the freeway and I'm on this long road through the desert and I pulled over because there was like this little like pavement part where you could turn off, and I got out to take a couple pictures of the car, and I like turned in a 360 and I realized that I couldn't see anything. There was the road, and there was nothing else, and there was no one on it. And I had this realization of like, okay, I'm in the middle of the desert. I'm on a deserted road. I'm in a Viper.
We have half a pack of cigarettes.
Right, exactly. It's like it's that mentality. And I just laid on it and just got into it, and it was great. But I'm glad I chose the Viper for that day, because after the lunch stop that we had, and I don't remember the town off the top of my head. It was Clifton, Arizona. When you're driving north from Clifton up US 191, it turns into, I think it's called the Clifton Alpine Highway, and you go through this gray section of mountains, and it's really tight, you know, left and right switchbacks and elevation changes and places where there's just no guardrails and any of that. And I mean, I'm pushing through there, and you know, I've done roads like that in other cars, and it's fun, but in the Viper, you really have to work. I mean, you know, you are managing that thing through second, third, fourth gear, mostly second and third. You know, the steering is good, but it's heavy. You got to lay into the throttle because there's no turbocharger, there's no supercharger. It's all just that naturally aspirated, high-revving V10 power, and you've really got to get that car going. I mean, there were so many times in the first sections of it where I realized I was like, oh shoot, I should have been in second, like don't have enough power right now. But the more you learn how that car works, the more rewarding it is to drive. And by the end of that stretch of road, I was totally happy in the Viper. I was so madly in love with that car. And while I'm sure I would have had just as much fun and probably could have done the whole thing faster in a Stingray, I'm really glad I was in the Viper, because it taught me a lot about like how to drive that car correctly,
right?
And how to find, yeah, I mean, I wasn't even close to the limits of that car. But the thing about the Viper is that, you know, you get to this point of where you feel like you're at the limit, but you know that car has so much more to it.
Yeah,
there's
that was
so much more
like,
it can do.
I don't know. Every time I drive the Viper, like, I love how visceral it is. I'm also terrified it's going to bite me.
That's the thing, is I was afraid to push it too hard, because I was like, the moment I take one of these turns 5 miles an hour faster than I'm already going is the turn where I go off.
Yeah.
And so, you just and roll to my death.
That was the last time anyone ever saw Stephen Ewing.
And then there's a very special episode of the Autoblog podcast when, you know.
I've killed off everybody so far. Why should you?
But my end of the day with the Viper was driving – again, through the middle of nowhere, and the low fuel light came on, and I was like, oh crap, I gotta fill up. And I looked, and the next town was like 35 miles away. So I immediately was like sixth gear, 65 miles an hour, like just kind of like limping it to the town.
Clearly you made it, so that's good.
I did make it. And then I'll just quickly go for the last day was the Challenger Hellcat, which the coolest part about that day was I can now say that I am an American, because I have now done several burnouts in a red Challenger Hellcat on Route 66, all for the sake of having fun. It was funny. I was pulled over at one point, just looking through some photos I had taken on my camera, and a couple of other cars sped past me. And when I caught up to them at lunch, they were like, yeah, we figured that was you, because we're driving down 66 and we just see like tire marks, red Challenger. And that car on that road, it just felt right. I mean, the Challenger on like the flat open Route 66, I even put Classic Rewind on the Sirius XM.
Right? See?
Like it just, and I took this picture, which I think I put on Twitter, but I'll have to do it again. I found this giant mural on the side of this roadside shop of this huge blue mural with the American flag waving and this eagle that was like swooping down to land.
Did it have three dogs and like a moon? And
no, but I remember I parked the Challenger in front of it and took that picture and was just like, that's what this is. Like, that is what this car is. It's Route 66 and burnouts and doing a, you know, crazy speed and just like, you know, you're cruising in sixth gear and all of a sudden you just have the urge to drop it to fourth and just lay into it because you can and because it's fun and it's awesome to do that. Driving it in traffic through Las Vegas, though, not thrilling.
So tell us about the Motley Crue concert.
So, yeah, so the event started. I went to, I'm sure some of our listeners are familiar with the Gas Monkey Garage. We went to a car show at the Gas Monkey Live where they had a bunch of Mopar people out there, and they all brought the Challengers and Chargers and Vipers and old cars, too. And then we went inside, and there was the Motley Crue concert, which I am not a Motley Crue fan, as you might expect.
I was just going to say, like, I hope that like it's cool and all. Like they seem to have dialed in part of their fan base, and that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, the
just
whole
hope
event
they evolve
was like
some of that a little bit.
Yeah, the whole event was very Mopar, you know, loud, fun, blah blah blah. Kickstart my heart.
It sounds like 45-year-old guys though. Like
yeah, basically.
Yeah,
I was easily the only people there that were younger than me were other journalists. or like kids of people.
Right.
So not my right. crowd, but
they were in the catering.
Yeah, exactly.
The catering crew.
The
so
bartenders.
I'm kind of curious, Steve, what was like the most like Americana thing you got to eat on this thing? We got music, we got cars. What about the food?
So we went to there's this place, the place where we went to in Clifton, Arizona. It was called, it's like some, I think it's like Tyler's or Travis's or Tommy's, something like that. It's Taste of Texas, which I found funny that we went to a place called Taste of Texas right after we had gotten into Arizona. But it was, I mean, you walk in. So the first thing is the place, and I didn't realize this, was at like 8,000 feet elevation. And so the air is thin. And then you walk inside and it's this big old like warehouse type of deal. With these like these big round tables with kind of the like the wood look laminate on them.
Oh, that's excellent.
And then just these like these cushy chairs that could lean back and were on wheels. And it was a barbecue joint and the whole place just smelled like barbecue. I mean, the whole place would just fill with smoke and there would just be this amazing scents. And the waitress came over and she sets the menu down. And there were these two British guys on the trip with us. And the one, you know, looks at the waitress and says, like, what would you recommend? Like, what should I have? And she just goes, you want the combo. And it was this just like barbecue platter. It had sausage and ribs and pulled pork.
Brisket,
and then
brisket.
Those four things. And then you got it with two sides. So I got it with the sweet corn and the potato salad. And it was just, I mean, solid barbecue, like some of the best barbecue I've had in years. It was
like ever,
but it was just this great, like, you know, you just these rib, when I say they literally fall off the bone, I mean, I picked it up and I bit into the ribs and the whole thing just fell apart in my hands. It went right down my shirt because I have exactly zero grace. but it just fell, and it was just this great smoky, barbecue-y, meaty. It was one of those things, like the only thing I could think to do to order with it was just like a Coke, just a regular glass of Coca-Cola. And it was perfect. It was so perfect. The food was delicious.
I'm pretty jealous. That sounds I'm a big barbecue guy. That sounds great. Right?
Yeah, the barbecue at that joint was just was outstanding. And then, I mean, we had some other really interesting food along the way. The hotel we were at in Winslow, Arizona was La Posada Hotel, which is actually kind of a famous hotel. And they have this restaurant where they do this like nice Southwestern, you know, flair on food. And it was just like a really good, like, Southern Mexican mix. Really great stuff there. The places we ate in Texas were all pretty good. It was just, you know, it was a really nice way to experience that part of America and to go through these little towns. And a lot of the people that we met, I mean, the first stop that I made, 3 hours into my trip in Texas, I had to get gas already. Because, you know, hell
can't imagine why. I mean, you know, supercharged V8 700 horsepower.
So I'm stopped at this I just like got off the freeway and just went to like, you know, the Sunoco or whatever that was right there. And I went inside to use the bathroom and to buy a water. And the girl behind the counter looks and points out the car and she goes, "That's the Hellcat, isn't it?" And it was it's the Charger. So it's the new Charger that isn't even out yet. And I said, "Yeah, it is." And she goes, I want that car. And I'm like, "You know the Charger Hellcat?" She's like, "Oh, yeah. I've been following that car since it came out." And like, she was so excited. But everywhere we went,
did you drop her business card? Like, Steve Autoblog.
I was wearing my I have a nice Autoblog jacket, and I just kind of pointed to it. Point of the logo was like, "You can read all about it here at autoblog.com."
Very nice.
So, but yeah, the people, the food, the scenery, it was just there's a photo I have where we were coming out of the Fort Davis mountain loop, and we had two Chargers and two Challengers at that point. And they were just lined up on the side of the road, and the sun was setting over the desert. And it was just, I mean, we just all got out of our cars and we just stood there and just watched as the sun went down. It was breathtaking. And to have that experience, it was the whole package. Like, those people in those cars through those towns on those roads in that part of the country, it was just like this big America thing. And I got it. And then I went to SEMA.
So what that means is, A, Kathy Chrysler, right? She was there?
No, Kathy was not there.
Kathy was not. I was going to say, because she you know, came out. I thought she was like the sort of the head of that stuff. The
no, the cars she does are not, they don't get Hellcatted.
Oh. Well, anyway, Chrysler gets sounds like they get kudos for this.
It was one of the best trips I've ever been on. I'm so thankful I got to do it, and I'm really excited to put the story together to share it with everyone.
And the Hellcats are on their own. Like, it sounds like you still like the Charger Hellcat, but now you have an appreciation for the Challenger.
Yeah, I love the Charger Hellcat. I still, you know, and I was talking to the engineers and the designers, and I flat out admit, I'm like, Challenger Hellcat, Challenger in general is not my kind of car at all. It just isn't. But I get it. And I understand why people are super into it. And I understand why people get really excited about it. Like, I get it. It's not for me, but I totally, totally get it. And I think this trip kind of helped me get it in a way.
Nice.
So that was that. I'm gonna shut up.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, SEMA left you horrified because it was all the metal flake paint and garishness you could stomach. And I guess the one thing I'll say about SEMA, because we talked about this a little last week too, was like, didn't SEMA used to be like this actual industry show? Because it seems like so commercial and like just this enormous pandemonium now.
Yeah, it was the aftermarket trade show.
And it's not anymore.
It's Lambo doors and big wheels and like Greg, Greg was at SEMA too. What did you see that was there like any one thing?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this year was, I mean, obviously the automakers just had really big presences as they have for probably the last 10, 15 years or more. You know, they're spending big money and they pretty much treat it just like an auto show.
Yeah. I mean,
there's scheduled press conferences. It's definitely evolved beyond this kind of like custom, you know, specialty, you know, trade show. It's really become this like, it's like a Frankfurt or a Geneva, if I can stretch to make that comparison.
Well, it's certainly as like big a Frankfurt as or Geneva.
It's like spread out as across as many different, you know, pieces of real estate as those shows too. It's huge,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have swept through as many clothing at SEMA as I have at any other auto show on the planet. So it's definitely a lot to walk and see and just, you know, experience it all. You know, this year, of course, you know, it was the Mustang was really big with, you know, the new generation of Mustang coming out. You know, Ford really, you know, they always seem to try and, like, you know, I would say just, you know, really grab, like, the best ones and put them in their stand. You really curate it. That's the word I'm looking for. And this year they had, like, a King Cobra that was, like, it was like a concept, if you will. But it basically is previewing what they're going to do with their drag, you know, their drag program next year. And then, you know, you kind of venture farther out into the floor away from it. And it was like every tuner had their own take on the new Mustang, on the old Mustang. The Mustang is just like, it seems like it's one of the unofficial cars of SEMA. You know, every corner, even at tire booths, at wheel booths, you know, if like some guy makes splitters out of a shop out of, you know, the middle of nowhere, Arizona, and he's got a Mustang on his stand, which is cool, but it's definitely one of those shows where there's a lot of excess, you know, there's just,
totally.
You see a lot of the same thing over and over, and it kind of blows your mind.
Yeah, it's a little much.
But, you know, this year, I think, you know, a couple years ago with the downturn of the economy and the downturn of the industry, SEMA did take a hit a little bit. You know, the automakers were spending a little less money. The tuners, frankly, had a lot less money. So it kind of, there was a period of, it was a downturn. You know, it was definitely much more civilized. Maybe, you know, some might say it went back to a little bit of a period of better taste. But that also meant there were some empty exhibit stands. There was some empty spaces on the floor. But, you know,
if you're kind of depressing for a while.
Yeah, I mean, 2008, 2009, go back to 2007. It was a little, you know, parts of some of those far-reaching halls were ghost towns. But the last few years, it's definitely, you know, there's been a big comeback. You know, obviously with the industry, with the overall economy, it was definitely reflected there, you know, this year in the last couple years. You know, people are spending money. People are, you know, really going for it as far as making cool custom cars. And frankly, you know, with automakers rolling out lots of, you know, they're investing in product. There's a lot more canvases for the tuners to work on, you know, like, you know, obviously the new Mustang, but the Scion FRS, you know, Honda had a bunch of different things going on with like the new Fit. Chevy is kind of trying to eke everything they can out of the, you know, this generation of the Camaro. But, you know, they also paid a lot of attention to the, you know, the Colorado, which is their new midsize truck, if you will, midsize, which is almost as big as a full-size truck. But, I mean, there were so many different kinds of Colorados, like lifestyle Colorados and off-road Colorados. And, you know, you sort of get a sense here a little bit below the radar of what automakers are really trying to, like, you know, promote and make their agenda. And, you know, you can definitely see the Colorado is obviously one of the most crucial launches for Chevy this year. And that was reflected at SEMA, too. You know, speaking of Mopar and all their horsepower, you know, Mopar is a little bit – they kind of have their own space. It's a little bit of a lower level in the central hall. And they showed their new funny car, which is just, you know, Mondo horsepower. It in this year, what they – yeah, I mean, they added, like – you know, all this like carbon fiber stuff to it, which they say makes it more rigid and such. And they had a very impressive display as well. You know, the new Jeeps, you know, some different riffs on the Ram. It was a good SEMA show. I mean, there was definitely strength for the industry there. You know,
there was a lot more to talk about this year in terms of like actual, you know, automaker funded projects and things like that. I mean, most people tend to go to SEMA and just focus on, you know, what's weird and what's wacky and what's overdone and all that. But you're seeing a lot more in the way of stuff that's actually got production mind and production intent to it. I mean, you'll see a car, you know, with a ton of performance modifications to it or parts to it. But then you realize that all those parts are going to be offered through a catalog, or they're going to be, you know, put into like a special edition of some car. And so it's not just about showing what's possible. It's about showing like, hey, like, here's what's possible, but we're going to do it. Like, we're going to offer this stuff to you guys. And what I thought was cool is that, you know, companies are taking cars that aren't even out yet. Like Jeep had two different takes on the Renegade, which is their new, you know, new little crossover, which isn't even on sale yet, but they're already showing it out there and saying, like, here's our Renegade. We've already got the aftermarket in mind for it. Mopar is already working on some stuff for it. So you're definitely seeing more of this, you know, automaker-backed stuff, which I think makes the show a little more substantial and a little more worthwhile.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to those two, you know, you mentioned, like, I think they were called the Riptide and the Frostbite, which on the surface you're thinking, oh, that's kind of funny. That's a little bit of a punchline. But, you know, a lot of those parts are really, they're going to show up in a catalog, and that's, you know, that's money that, you know, the dealers can make, that Mopar makes. And frankly, they really dress up what's, you know, kind of a glorified Fiat 500L, I believe.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, they really, you know, a lot of the things there really, they add performance, they add character to cars that, you know, a lot of people like. You know, maybe you don't, you know, check every single box, you know, and make your own Riptide, but you get, like, you get some of the floor mats or something, and that, you know, enhances the experience.
Yeah, well, and I mean, the cars that show up at SEMA, you know, you've got the stalwart Mustangs and Camaros and Jeeps, obviously, and then the trucks and stuff. These are, like, these are grown men's American Girl dolls. Like, so you're basically looking at the accessory catalog for what's essentially a plaything, in a lot of ways, and it's fine. Like, it's a hobby, so that it's cool, but you know, that's what this is, and it, you know, it's good that it's just an enormous show, I guess, and it supports the hobby. But man, some of the stuff there is just.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
they left still, taste at the door.
You still got that. That's still out there. And, you know, I think there's part of me that doesn't ever want that to go away. But, you know.
Yeah, it's never going to go away because
that's all we can say about it. SEMA.
Yeah, you know, Greg, before we move on, actually, one of the things that I sort of neglected to do right off the top was so this is your first time on the podcast, but you've been around the business. So when you talk about SEMA, you come at it from a point of, like, having seen it for a number of years and a point of reference. So give us a little bit of your background in, like, you know, 2.5 minutes.
Sure, sure. Well, it's not that much of a storied history, but. I've been at Autoblog here for 4 or 5 months almost, really enjoying it, psyched to be here.
Yeah, and, that'll pass.
What's that?
That'll pass.
Right,
I'm kidding,
right.
Kidding.
But, Dan, don't that, tell
I
him.
I did Automobile Magazine, you know, one of the buff books, great place, you know, really high priority on writing and such. I did car reviews for them. Worked there for a year. Really good place to be. I actually, for the last 6 months or so I was there, I edited what they call Ignition. So that's like their news section.
That was fun
because I like to be, you know, try and have my fingers on the pulse of the industry, if you will. I know it's a cliche, but so, you know, I did that. And the last 5 years before that, I was at Auto Week. So, you know, kind of working my ways through pretty much everything that begins with auto and then, you know, fill in the other four letters. But yeah, Auto Week was a great place. I kind of got my start in the industry there. I ended up being their news editor. So that was a great way, you know, again, to really be connected with the industry and, you know, meet a lot of, you know, the designers, the executives, and just, you know, in general, know what's going on and try and, you know, create something that's bigger than you, you know, do sort of something that really has meaning. And yeah, it was a great 5 years. So now I'm at Autoblog and, you know, just excited to be here. I love all these, like, the podcasts and the videos and stuff like that. It's like, that's what's great about working for a digital platform is you can kind of come at the reader from more ways than they know how to deal with.
Oh yeah, so we have them surrounded. Yeah,
we absolutely. Do. We weren't joking about that whole obsessively covered business.
Yeah.
So, psyched to be here. And I mean, that's pretty much me. I mean, I like scrambled eggs. I like cold beer, you know. And
together, scrambled eggs and cold beer sounds like a good time.
That's only on tailgates, but yeah.
That's a pretty decent breakfast, I'm not going to lie. May or may not have had that recently.
Like this morning. We won't go into that. But I'm sure your experience in watching the industry has sort of told you the tale of Jim Farley, And his move from Toyota to Ford to whatever. He's made another move, and you actually wrote the post. So Jim Farley's jumping to head Ford of Europe, and I don't know whether it's Ford of Europe needs help or this is sort of penance for Jim Farley. Do you have any feeling on what's going on?
Well, I think this does two things. Ford of Europe is definitely they're not in as much trouble as they were, but they're having some tough times, to say the least. They're struggling against Volkswagen and some of the European, you know, based automakers. And this gives Jim Farley a chance to really have operational control. You know, for the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, he's been the marketing guy at Ford, which is obviously, that's a very important job for a company the size of Ford that has, you know, such a wide scope of products. But the fact of the matter is it was one area, basically. It was marketing, which, you know, includes communications and advertising, all that. But now he's in charge of, like, basically his own little kingdom. And this is good for Jim Farley. It, you know, I'm sure Ford and Mark Fields, they think it will be good for Ford. And it gives him a chance to maybe get a little bit more of the spotlight to make himself noticed a little bit more. And if Mark Fields, you know, if he ever decides to step down, he's still a very relatively young man. In fact, I think him and Farley are both the same age, in their early 50s. But this gives him a good chance to really be in the right spot to succeed Mark Fields if, you know, Fields steps down. Secondly, it gives them a chance to really get Ford of Europe right. Ford and General Motors have struggled in Europe pretty much for the last, you know, 30, 40 years, depending, you know, however you want to calculate that, you know, and this gives them a chance to get, you know, their product portfolio lined up, try and get the right products in the right market, get the pricing in line. And, you know, this will be a great challenge for Jim Farley. You know, he's one of the better, like, enthusiast executives in the industry. Like, some executives are very much, you know, they're into, like, the bean counter side of it, or they're into the, like, the marketing, you know, the Mad Men style kind of marketing. And Jim's an enthusiast, you know? I mean, I can recall seeing him at, like, you know, on one of the straightaways at Laguna Seca, and, you know, he'd be the guy who's like, here, let me get behind the wheel of this Boss 302 and, you know, show the journalist what's, you know, what's what with it. So, you know, he's got horsepower in his veins, and, you know, it'll be a challenge for him to definitely try and have all of this operational responsibility in Europe. But the guy who's coming here, it's almost like a trade, if you will. The head of, you know, Ford's European operations, Stephen O'Dell, is a very well-regarded executive. He did a good job over there, and he has a little bit of marketing in his background as well. So he's going to come back to the United States. I'm not sure if he's going to live here full time or how that's going to shake out, but he'll have, you know, he'll have say over Ford's U.S. marketing, which is a big deal for them and for him, you know, because he's going to control their message going forward. So it's a really interesting move, especially here in Detroit, where, like, executive moves, it's like a parlor game, you know, like, nobody, you know, everybody likes to know about the palace intrigue, like who's going where, you know, it's almost like baseball free agency or something. So we'll see. I mean, you know, they're both well-regarded executives, and it's one of those things where the results 2 or 3 years down the road will kind of, you know, see if this was successful.
Yeah, well, and I've heard too that, like, Farley's style is different than Odell's. Odell's is really detail-oriented, where Jim Farley's a big-picture thinker. And so that'll be interesting to sort of see if sort of getting in these two different sandboxes sort of kickstarts these guys into thinking differently, and they bring some stuff. Like, now they're a fish out of water, right? If I'm going to use more metaphors, sandboxes, fish right. out of water, whatever. But you know, they're like a stranger in a strange land, so that may actually invigorate what they do in those markets. It just seemed weird to me, like, hey, we're going to take the U.S. guy and send him to Europe, and we're going to take the Europe guy and send him to the U.S. It's a weird shuffle.
It's a lateral move for both of them, too, and they both had really, you know, really impressive careers. You know, Farley, of course, was, you know, one of the guys who helped launch Scion. He, I believe he ran Toyota brand marketing for, you know, Toyota's, you know, division in the U.S. You know, Dell, of course, was CEO of Volvo when Ford owned Volvo. So they both have great resumes. It's one of those things where, you know, you kind of wonder, you know, read between the lines, what might be next for them, what might be next for Ford. It's, and yeah, I mean, it's a lateral move. They're both, you know, so high up in the stratosphere. When you call up Ford's webpage, there's pretty much Bill Ford and Mark Fields, and then these two guys. Like, they're both about as high up in the company as you can go. So I think the move to watch, especially, though, is Jim Farley, because Odell's 59, and you figure Mark Fields is about 54, I think. You know, it would happen out of sequence for Odell to somehow succeed Mark Fields. But for Jim Farley, he's younger. You know, who knows? Maybe this could be positioning him for, you know, move up the ladder down the line, you know, if and when Fields ever steps down.
Well, and that is very interesting, too, because Fields, he went from – he did his time in Ford of Europe.
Right.
And that gave him sort of the global experience that you don't necessarily get just staying in the States operation.
Right.
And I mean, I know that Farley had experience at Toyota as well. And mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe they're sending him over there to sort of bone up on the global operation and then come back for a higher up position.
And of course, there's another gentleman by the name of Joe Henrich, who is he holds another very high ranking title in North America. He's essentially Ford's, like, you know, COO, but I don't believe that's his title. So, you know, there's always, if Ford and all of the Detroit automakers, there's always like two or three guys who are like right below the CEO. And then, of course, you know, it leads to all of this great speculation, like, well, who's going to be next, you know? So, I mean, it's like quarterback of the Lions or something. Everybody always likes the backup, you know?
Quarterback of the Lions. That's a thankless position.
Exactly.
Well, I'm sure we'll sort of keep an eye on that and see what we see in the next couple of years. I guess it does also beg the question of, like, you know, what does it mean for Lincoln and where does Lincoln go? Is Odell going to sort of touch that and see if he can bring any kind of special magic to Lincoln? Or, you know, I just want to see how it shifts and how it changes and what Ford does, because it seems like kind of a momentous move, even though it is a lateral move for both of those guys. So,
yeah. And the Lincoln brand, too, was that was part of Farley's responsibility for a while. But they also appointed sort of like a special vice president who is in charge of it. And that's like his baby going forward. He's, you know, he has global responsibilities. And this is one of the first times, you know, at least in recent memory, that they've given Lincoln some degree of autonomy. So, you know, maybe he'll be able to have that kind of sway over his own empire in regards to Lincoln. And then Odell will have the, you know, the ultimate responsibility in regards to marketing and sales.
Wow. They are on notice. We're keeping our eyes on them.
Right.
Indeed.
All right, let's do the last topic here, LA Auto Show, because we're getting into Auto Show season.
And, next week, man.
Yeah, that means LA sort of kicks it off, right? LA, and then we're on to Detroit very shortly after.
Yep.
And then Chicago.
Chicago, and then Geneva, New York, China, summer, Pebble Beach.
Yeah, you just got ahead of yourself there, Pebble Beach.
I'm just saying, it repeats. And then
yeah.
It's one of those things where I always think about, like, oh, yeah, we've got this show and then this show and then this show. And I sort of work through them all. And then I'm like, God, when did I get old? Right.
I do that every day. I look in the mirror. I go, it's like, I'm going to do that.
And it's like, and then I'm going to be, you know, then I'm going to be 50. And then, right? I'm going to be 80. And, you know, so. But yeah, LA Auto Show is next week.
Yeah, and you know, like, yeah, as we kick off Auto Show season, we're not going to be able to send our intrepid Mike Harley because he split for another job.
I know. Well, he'll be there.
I know. Yeah, but not for us.
Harley, we should give an update since he was a regular on the podcast for a while.
I did not chase him away.
With the good sense to say, I didn't. He sent me cookies. Why would I ever have chased that man
away?
He
didn't send me anything.
I sent him McLarens and Ferraris. And Lambos. over and over again.
I'll send you cookies if you send me those things.
How about this? I will send you a bench seat Impala rental, and then I'll get you a Gallant. And
this I'll get you all
the cars of your dreams. I can't even. It's to the point now, Dan. I want Dan and everyone that listens regularly to know this. I cannot see a Mitsubishi Gallant, and I can't even say the word Gallant without smiling like a fool and giggling. Because every time I see one on the road, I'm just like,
there see? It goes. See what we've done for you? And you're like, you son of a...
But yeah, so Mike Carley has left to start or to head up kind of an exciting new adventure for him. There is a website that is just sort of coming up called AutoWeb, and it's more of a like search engine based automotive site right now. And Harley has been tasked with building an editorial team and building content and sort of going out there as the public face and kind of getting people excited about it. And doing all that, which, I mean, anyone that ever met Mike Harley knows he was just a great guy to hang out with and be around, a great networker. I mean, I always really enjoyed having him as sort of the face of Autoblog on the West Coast. And I mean, I'll miss him a lot, and I'll miss his contributions to the site and to the podcast. And I'll just miss hanging out with him. I mean, I loved every year at Chicago Auto Show. We would always go out for our pizza and beer dinner, and I always genuinely had a great time hanging out with Harley, and you know, I really respected him as a coworker and a colleague and all that. So I wish him the best, and everyone else here does too. We're well sad to have lost him, but we're also very excited for him that he gets to kind of start something fresh and, you know, build something up new. And it's an exciting opportunity, and I'm sure he's going to do a wonderful job. So that's where Harley went, and we'll miss him, but we're also very happy for him.
When you're in LA for the LA Auto Show, I'm sure you'll see him.
I will. He'll be there, and I have plans to see him. I'm actually I'm going to be staying in LA for a little while. So
at the Harley's house. He offered.
He did offer. I'm just going to show up and knock on his door like, hey.
Mike, I'm here. Right. Here's my bag. Right. So what else are we going to see at LA besides Mike Harley, though?
So there's couple big things that we know about. Cadillac is going to show the new ATS-V, which we've seen spy shots of, and it looks like it should be awesome. The new Ford Explorer is going to be there. There is the all-wheel drive Jag F-Type. Audi has a new A9 concept. We're going to see – let's see what else is on here.
I know the most important one. Volvo V60
Cross Country, the Dan Roth special.
That's actually probably a very important car for them.
It is. I'm sure it is. And I hope if it's anything, I mean, I've driven the V60 and it's great. So I don't see how this couldn't be wonderful. But there's a lot of really cool little things. The new little Honda HR-V crossover is going to be there. The Mazda CX-3 crossover, the little tiny one. Scion has some sort of weird IM concept that will be there.
Well, Scion hasn't had anything since Jim Farley left.
No, Scion, I mean, the only new thing Scion has really done recently is the FRS. Right. That was the most recent thing. So, I mean, really, it's nice to see some attention being paid to Scion. So, other than that, there's some other stuff we can't really talk about right now. New Ford Explorer was confirmed to debut there. The Mustang GT350 is said to be coming to LA. And then just a couple of other little filler things like Porsche Cayenne GTS and 911 GTS and
Final some stuff.
R8 competition model. There's going to be some cars. Oh, and then some crazy like Fisker and Galpin creation that they're calling the ultimate American muscle car. So it will not be a boring show. That will be a thing.
Yeah.
Plus, we'll be announcing the winner of the 2014 Autoblog Technology of the Year Award.
Excellent. And
the biggest news of all right there.
Right, exactly. Obviously.
Clearly.
Are we going to reveal that live? Obviously on like
it's going to network be revealed. Television? We have helicopters and seven different networks. No, it'll be it's going to be revealed Wednesday night. That's all I can say right now.
Are you excited? Do you know what it is?
I do not know what it is.
Awesome. So you're going to be a surprise to the rest of us. There was a lot of tech. You guys were sort of busy. I know Pockert was like driving stuff for the Tech Awards, driving stuff for NACTOY, and
yeah, Pockert's been driving everything. No, we had 14 cars at our roundup of testing, and we nailed it down to a smaller group of finalists, which will be announced at the award, and then one of those will be the one that actually wins. And I honestly do not know which one won yet, so I'll find out when the rest of you do.
Excellent. Good. And then you can find out if you think everybody who voted was crazy, or if
right, I'll find out and either go, oh great, all right, or I'll look over at everyone else, all my colleagues, and they're going, what the hell is wrong with you people?
Right. But I generally do that anyway for a variety of other reasons. But
yeah, I know.
all right, let's do Q&A because that's all we can talk about for LA is like what we think we're going to see, and there's some things we know we're going to see that we can't tell you yet. So
we'll know more, next week before the show, so we can update on it then.
Excellent. So. Well, in the meantime, stay on the edge of your seats and watch, for everything for Audible, because you're going to see those like inevitable leaks
that
pop up because nothing is secret anymore with the internet.
Right.
But all right, Q&A. I've got a couple. There was actually a bunch of good stuff here this week. So the first one was, why don't car companies re-release old models that everyone loves? I would love to buy a 2015 Supra or a 2014 S2000. Are they not able to fit in new safety standards? What is stopping them from retroing older classics?
It depends. I mean, sometimes you'll see, you'll see a name revived, like a Dodge Dart. A Dodge Dart now and a Dodge Dart then are two different things.
Very.
But sometimes, I mean, I kind of think anyway, there's the idea of recognizing a classic before it's a classic. And if you keep something going for too long, it doesn't really get the chance to become a collectible or a classic. Like, like an S2000, I would love there to be a new S2000, but now it makes the S2000 that was sort of extra special to me in a way that a Miata isn't really. I mean, I love a Miata, but the S2000 is just kind of like, ooh.
The S2000 was like a sport bike with doors.
Dude, you could rev that thing to 9,000 RPM, and that you had to get the power out of it.
you thought it was rough, Greg?
Yeah, I thought it really abused you a little bit on, like, just open roads and daily driving. I mean, it was a great car for the track, great car for twisting roads, but
that car was so fun all the time.
Yeah, it was a great time for sure, but
it was just it's what I love about, little Hondas, where you just have to beat the hell out of it to get it to do what you want it to do.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, because the thing, it didn't have a ton of power, and all of it was at like 8,000.
Yeah, it was thrilling to rev the crap out of it, though, and it handled really well. It handled better than a Miata.
It had a beautiful gearbox, too.
Yeah, great gearbox, great steering, and it had one of the most simplistic interiors I've ever been in my life. And I mean, I loved that car. I remember when that car came out, I was so excited about it.
Yeah.
To touch on the question a little bit too, I think what people really want is they don't really want like a 1970s Challenger or something. They want maybe a car that looks like it, but that has all the modern amenities,
So they want a new Challenger.
Exactly. They don't want, nobody wants drum brakes and like an 8-track, I mean, so I think there's sort of like one of those things too where, people see the past through rose-colored glasses, and it's
totally.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played. Sorry.
Right.
don't make me do my impression.
A Chevelle, absolutely. But I mean, you would want a modern Chevelle that maybe had some retro styling cues. At least I think most people who you know, subscribe to these theories of, hey, let's bring back this car, bring back that car.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the safety has a big part to do with it. Like,
absolutely,
people want a car that reminds them of those cars that they're fond of, but they also want it to start every day, and they want it to not disintegrate in a crash and be able to keep up with modern traffic and stop and turn. And like, that's one of the things that's kind of terrifying about owning a classic car is everything else on the road is going to demolish you if it hits you, and they can stop so much faster than you. Like, especially when you get into the 50s cars, like they're just not the same.
True.
And it's cool to have those classics, but I think, yeah, the other part of it too is that it's just not economical. Like, automakers can't keep building everything forever. And if they're going to sell like four of them, everybody's going to love it, right? They're going to be so happy. Like, oh, they brought back the 57 Bel Air. Cool. But nobody's going to buy it. They're just going to talk about how cool it is that you can buy it. So they have to do something that, you know, it leverages a platform that they've already got in place that is making them money. And they can take that and put a different, you know, top hat on it or something and style it up and at least evoke those memories without building the actual old school car, because that's just not economically feasible.
Right.
So I think we killed that one dead.
Definitely.
All right. Last week, Dave Merrick of Acura was quoted as not understanding why people don't see Acura as a performance brand. They did not help themselves today when we saw a Acura minivan, possibly, in spy shots.
Yeah.
This is Rob in Illinois. He's saying, how does he think anyone could see Acura as a performance brand when they've only got one performance car purportedly on the way and they're working on a minivan?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because I think he's, you know, if it's the quote I'm realizing here, I think I took that quote. I had that in the story I wrote last week, and Dave's a big performance guy. He's into racing. He's into customizing. He's a real enthusiast, and, you know, he wants Acura to be a performance brand, but, you know, the reality is, you know, they have the NSX coming, and right now they have a lineup of, you know, very nice cars, but they're definitely not exactly adrenaline inducing, if you will. So, I mean, you know, it'd be nice to see them do a few more, you know, sort of even in between performance cars, but, you know, it's, you know, we'll see what they can come up with. You know, I mean, is it, you know, are you happy with like a paint and a sticker package or some wheels or maybe 20 extra horsepower here or there? But, you know, right now they don't have rear-wheel drive. They don't have a V8. And those are the facts, you know.
But do they need those things?
I mean, I would say they probably don't. They sell enough cars. They get a good value for their, you know, for their customer base. You know, as an enthusiast, sure, I'd love to see, you know, the NSX be the halo and then a couple cars in between. But do they need to do it? You know, maybe they don't.
I mean, I could see a minivan done right. Like, there is not you know, like we call it sports sedans, right? There's not a sport minivan. There's not a sport luxury minivan. Like, there are luxuriously outfitted minivans, but there's no, like, R-Class AMG sort of successor here. That's a niche. They could fill it. I don't know if it would be successful for them, but I'd love to try that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely love to try that.
Yeah, it's a fine line. I mean, I think as enthusiasts, we're all like, yeah, Acura, do this. This is great. Totally, you know, go for it. But I mean, the reality is they sell a decent amount of cars. You know, I'm sure they'd like to sell more, perhaps. They'd like to maybe have a little bit higher of a, you know, recognition in the enthusiast community. And they're definitely trying to do that, you know, with the big presence at SEMA and whatnot. But do they absolutely need to? I mean, you know, that's up for debate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're competition too. Like, they want to be lumped in with BMW and Mercedes and those high end brands. And I don't know that I don't know that people think of them that way.
No.
So they may have some work to do. I love Acura's cars. I really do like to drive them. I am gonna miss the ZDX because it's bonkers. even the sort of weird splay leg seating position and crazy price. But Acura, I don't know where they have to go. They have to carve out a niche that's a little bit more defined. You know, they used to have the Legend and the Integra, and you knew what they were. And now it's like Acura is its own kind of alphabet soup, and you're not quite sure. They've got all these cars that are sort of slight variations on a theme. They all seem kind of tightly lumped together. So maybe he can differentiate the models a little bit more and make them all a little bit more individual, and we'll go from there. The TLX sounds like it's going to be awesome. So I can't wait to drive that one. Steve, get me a TLX.
Okay. Done.
Yeah. Sure. All right. Nick wants to know some relevant consumer advice. His coworker is looking for, he and his coworker are both looking for this two-seater to commute to work in. And they each commute along with one other person. So one inexpensive two-seaters are out there. Nick's budget is $5K and his buddy's is $15K.
Miatas.
Yeah.
Used Miatas. Heavily
used Miatas. Used S2000.
S2000 for $15K, absolutely. 5,000 S2000 might not be a good...
Yeah, but a $15K S2000, that's pretty good.
Get yourself a Nissan Z.
You can get yourself a Z, that's true.
What about like an old RX-7 or something? Maybe got beat on a little bit?
Well, yeah. Maybe. What about two-seater?
Ooh, it's a good question.
$15K on the high end.
Audi TT? Is that a
two-seater? Yeah, but that has, I mean, that has back seats, but it's basically a two-seater.
Boxster. $15,000 Boxster.
Yeah, that'd be cool. That would actually be a lot of fun.
I have a lot of miles on it. But.
Yeah, but that'd be a lot of fun. What about? God, I can't think of anything else at the moment.
Oh, I know one of those. The early '90s Mercury Capri.
Some inside baseball here,
right?
You know what? If we're going strictly by the definition of two-seater, you can get a Ford Lightning. I'm just joking. Don't call it Lightning.
I like the way you're playing fast and loose with the rules, though, you know?
I mean, if my only stipulation is two-seater, I mean, Cyclone. By that logic, I would say, you know, you can go get yourself like an old Sprinter. That'd be cool. An old cargo Sprinter with two seats. Or like a nice used Econoline.
I think what
cargo.
They're looking for is stuff that's good to drive, though.
The Sprinter is great to drive, thank you.
No.
Yes, Dan. No. Stop now.
It's
Dan.
It's not Miata great to drive.
No, but it's great in a great way.
It's like for a van, it's great to drive. That's like saying like it hurts less to smash this toe than the other one.
I'm just saying you can get a two-seat Sprinter for $15,000, and it's great to drive. So it's checking all the boxes.
I mean, like it's great to drive compared to walking.
Well, no, it's great. I'm not having this argument with you right now.
I fundamentally disagree with your premise, Steve.
I'm just being, you know, just trying to be fun.
I'm trying to think of like something bonkers.
Just buy a Miata. You'll love a Miata.
No, get something weird.
Does a Fiero have a back seat? It's been a while.
Oh, Fiero. Man. Fiero would be a good time.
Fiero would be great.
Well, because the Fiero, especially with the four-cylinder, that was designed as a high-mileage car, but you're going to hate yourself for buying a four-cylinder Fiero, like a 2M4, when you could have gotten the GT with the V6, because that's the one. Like an 88 Fiero GT with the V6. They fixed all the problems. They didn't catch themselves on fire anymore. They redesigned the suspension and stuff, and then they killed it. So
go get a. You can get a Plymouth Prowler. How about that?
No. No.
Nice purple Prowler.
Oh, a purple one, too. Yeah.
I think a purple one would be okay. It would be acceptable.
I mean...
Just a nice big old slow Prowler.
They're not terribly slow.
They're
just
slow.
Terrible.
They're just bad.
Yeah.
Just HHR.
Yeah, the HHR. Yeah.
Oof. You could probably, for the 15, you could probably get like a Z3.
That actually, I mean, that car has a lot to recommend it.
Yeah. A Z3 is good. Or if you can find like a Z3 coupe, those don't actually have back seats.
In all seriousness, that's actually a strong move. That's, you know, if you're looking to really spend money, that's...
It's That's fun. Great. It's not a Miata. It's fun in a different way. That'd be cool.
You see, I'm not sure whether they mean like convertibles or whether they mean like two seater, you know, cars. Because you can get yourself.
Or if they mean two seat Sprinter,
right? Sure.
I'm just throwing that out there, Dan.
You so can... I mean, yeah, and you could take in extra income, like as a courier.
Yeah. See, it's a win-win situation, Dan.
Okay. You know what, so. Steve? You win. It's a win for you.
Yes, it is. It is always a win for me when there's a Sprinter involved.
All right, cool. Let's do one more with all the various models of the new Mustang coming out. Which one do you think will be the best bang for the buck?
EcoBoost manual.
Ditto.
Damn it. We all agree.
Oh.
That sucks. I drove both the EcoBoost automatic and the GT manual last week. And the GT I thought was hilarious, but the EcoBoost was it rode better, it handled more precisely, it was plenty entertaining. So I think that that car would be the one that I could live with on a daily basis more favorably. But there would be times where I'd miss the V8.
Sure, of course, but I still think the EcoBoost manual is the one I would buy.
The EcoBoost just felt like. Just more of a partner, where the V8 is so much more burly. You kind of got to like throw that car around by the scruff of its neck, where the EcoBoost is a little bit more delicate in its movements. I don't know. That car, I'm super impressed with that car. It's really solid. The chassis is tuned really well. I actually, like I said, I recorded my notes. I should make like a little addendum podcast so you can just listen to me babble. And I drove them at night in the rain, which was thrilling. but yeah, I think the EcoBoost is really going to be the sweet spot for the Mustang. Just whatever you do, don't buy the V6.
Yeah.
That's fair. Yeah. So, all right, cool. Well, let's put an end to podcast 405. So Greg Migliori, Steve Ewing, thanks for joining us.
It was fun.
Yeah, we'll have you guys back again. And cool. So we will see you guys next week. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Later.
You can subscribe to the Autoblog Podcast in iTunes, send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com, or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.